girls. Like Lydia, no real friends. Hannah and Nath recognize a few professors from the university, their father's teaching assistant. But most of the faces in the chairs are strangers. Why are they even here? Nath wonders. And when the service starts and they all crane their necks toward the coffin at the front, under the sassafras tree, he understands. They are drawn by the spectacle of sudden death. For the past week, ever since the police dragged the lake, the headlines in the Middlewood Monitor have all been about Lydia. Oriental girl found drowned in pond. The minister looks like President Ford, flat-browed, white-toothed, clean-cut, and solid. The Lees do not attend church, but the funeral home had recommended him, and James had accepted without asking any questions. Now James sits up straight, pressing the chairs back into his shoulder blades, and tries to listen to the service. The minister reads the 23rd Psalm, but in the revised text. I have everything I need instead of I shall not want. Even if I walk through a very dark valley instead of yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It feels disrespectful. A corner cut. Like burying his daughter in a plywood box. What else could you expect from this town? He thinks. On his right, the scent of the lilies on the casket hits Marilyn like a warm, wet fog, and she nearly retches. For the first time, she wishes she were the sort of woman, like her mother, who carried a handkerchief. She would have pressed it to her face and let it filter the air. And when she lowered it, the cloth would be dirty pink, the color of old bricks. Beside her, Hannah knits her fingers. She would like to worm her hand into her mother's lap, but she doesn't dare. Nor does she dare look at the coffin. Lydia is not inside, she reminds herself, taking a deep breath. Only her body. But then where is Lydia herself? Everyone is so still that to the birds floating overhead, she thinks, they must look like a cluster of statues. Out of the corner of his eye, Nath spots Jack sitting at the edge of the crowd beside his mother. He imagines grabbing Jack by the shirt collar to find out what he knows. For the past week, his father has called the police every morning asking for new information. But Officer Fisk says only, over and over, that they are still investigating. If only the police were here now, Nath thinks. Should he tell his father? Jack stares at the ground in front of him, as if he is too ashamed to look up. And then, when Nath himself glances back to the front, the coffin has already been lowered into the ground. The polished wood, the white lilies fastened to its top, vanished, just like that. Nothing but the blank space where it had once stood. He's missed it all. His sister is gone. Something wet touches his neck. He reaches up to wipe it away and discovers that his whole face is wet, that he's been crying silently. On the other side of the crowd, Jack's blue eyes are suddenly fixed on him, and Nath blots his cheek in the crook of his arm. The mourners begin to leave, a thin line of backs filing toward the parking area and the street. A few of Nath's classmates, like Miles Fuller, give him a sympathetic glance, but most, embarrassed by his tears, decide not to speak to him and turn away. They won't have another chance. In light of Nath's high grades and the tragic situation, the principal will exempt him from the last 3 weeks of school. And Nath himself will decide not to attend commencement. Some of the neighbors circle the Lees, squeezing their arms and murmuring condolences. A few of them pat Hannah on the head as if she's a tiny child or a dog. except for Janet Wolfe, her usual white doctor's coat replaced by a trim black suit. James and Marilyn don't recognize most of them. By the time Janet reaches her, Marilyn's palms feel grimy, her whole body dirty, like a rag passed from hand to soiled hand, and she can barely stand Janet's touch on her elbow. On the other side of the grave, Jack stands off to the side, waiting for his mother, half hidden in the shadow of a big elm. Nath weaves his way over, cornering him against the tree trunk, and Hannah, trapped at her parents' side by a thicket of adults, watches her brother nervously.
"What are you doing here?"
Nath demands. Up close he can see that Jack's shirt is dark blue, not black. That though he's wearing dress pants, he still has on his old black-and-white tennis shoes with the hole in the toe.
"Hey," Jack says, eyes still on the ground. "Nath, how are you?"
"How do you think I am?"
Nate's voice cracks, and he hates himself for it.
"I gotta go," Jack says. "My mom's waiting."
A pause.
"I'm really sorry about your sister."
He turns away, and Nath catches him by the arm.
"Are you?"
He's never grabbed anyone before, and he feels tough doing it, like a detective in a movie.
"You know, the police want to talk to you."
People are beginning to stare. James and Marilyn hear their son's raised voice and look around, but he doesn't care. He leans in closer, almost to Jack's nose.
"Look, I know she was with you that Monday."
For the first time, Jack looks Nathan in the face, a flash of startled blue eyes.
"She told you?"
Nath lurches forward so that he and Jack are chest to chest. Blood throbs in his right temple.
"She didn't have to tell me. Do you think I'm stupid?"
"Look, Nath,"
Jack mumbles,
"if Lydia told you that I..."
He breaks off suddenly, as Nath's parents and Dr. Wolfe come within earshot. Nath stumbles backward a few steps, glaring at Jack, at his father for interrupting, at the elm tree itself for not being farther away.
"Jack," Dr. Wolfe says sharply, "everything all right?"
"Fine,"
Jack glances at Nath, then at the adults.
"Mr. Lee, Mrs. Lee, I'm very sorry for your loss."
"Thank you for coming," says James.
He waits until the Wolfes have started down the curving path out of the cemetery before grabbing Nath by the shoulder.
"What's the matter with you?" he hisses. "Picking a fight at your sister's funeral."
Behind his mother, Jack gives a quick backward glance, and when his gaze meets Nath's, there's no doubt. He is frightened. Then he turns the curve and is gone. Nath lets out his breath.
"That bastard knows something about Lydia. You don't go around making trouble. You let the police do their work."
"James," Marilyn says, "don't shout."
She touches her fingers to her temple as if she has a headache and closes her eyes. To Nath's horror, a dark drop of blood runs down the side of her face.
"No, it's only a tear, stained black by mascara, leaving a dirty gray trail on her cheek."
Hannah, her small heart awash in pity, reaches up to take her hand. But her mother doesn't notice. In a moment, Hannah contents herself by clasping her own fingers behind her back. James fishes in his jacket pocket for his keys.
"I'm taking your mother and sister home. When you've cooled off, you can walk."
As the words leave his mouth, he winces. Deep inside, he wants more than anything to calm Nath, to put a comforting and weighty hand on his shoulder, to fold him into his arms on this day of all days.
but already it takes all his strength to keep his own face from crumpling, to stop his own knees from buckling and spilling him to the ground. He turns away and grabs Hannah's arm. Hannah, at least, always does what she's told. Nath sinks down on the roots of the elm and watches his parents head back toward the car, Hannah trailing after them with one wistful backward glance. His father doesn't know what Jack is like. Jack has lived down the street from them for 11 years, since he and Nath were in the first grade, and to Nath's parents he is just a neighbor boy, the scruffy one with the dog and that old second-hand car. In school, though, everyone knows. Every few weeks a different girl. Every girl the same story. Jack doesn't date. There are no dinners out, no flowers, no boxes of chocolates and cellophane wrap. He simply drives the girl out to the point or the drive-in or a parking lot somewhere and spreads a blanket across the back seat of his car. A week or two later, he stops calling and moves on. He's known to make a specialty of deflowering virgins. At school, the girls are proud of it, like they've joined an exclusive club. Clustered at their lockers, they whisper a giggling, salacious play-by-play. Jack himself talks to no one. It's common knowledge that he's alone most of the time. His mother works night shifts at the hospital 6 nights a week. He does not eat in the school cafeteria. He does not go to the dances. In class, he sits in the back row, picking the next girl he'll ask for a ride. This spring, he had picked Lydia. Nath huddles in the cemetery an hour, 2 hours, 3, watching the cemetery workers stack the folding chairs, gather the flowers, pluck balled-up papers and tissues from the grass. In his mind, he dredges up every single thing he's ever heard about Jack. Every fact, every rumor. The two begin to blur. And by the time he is ready to head home, he is bubbling with a terrible fury. He tries to imagine Lydia with Jack. Tries desperately not to picture them together. Had Jack hurt her somehow? He doesn't know. He knows only that Jack is at the heart of everything, and he promises himself he will find out how. Only when the gravediggers lift their shovels and approach the open grave does Nath clamber to his feet and turn away. As he skirts the edge of the lake and turns onto their street, he spots a police car parked outside Jack's house. About goddamn time, Nath thinks. He sidles closer to the house, slouching below the line of windows. Behind the screen, the front door stands open, and he climbs the porch stairs on his toes, sticking to the edges of the worn boards, making sure they don't squeak. It's his sister they're talking about, he tells himself with each step. He has every right. At the top, he leans toward the screen door. He can't see anything except the entryway, but he can hear Jack in the living room, explaining slowly, loudly, as if it's the second or third time. She had skipped ahead into physics. Her mom wanted her in with the juniors. You were in that class. Aren't you a senior? I told you, Jack says, impatient. I had to take it over. I failed. Dr. Wolf's voice now. He has a B+ in the class this term. I told you you'd do fine if you would just do the work, Jack. Outside, Nath blinks. Jack? A B+? A rustle, as if the policeman has turned the page of a notebook. Then, what was the nature of your relationship with Lydia? The sound of his sister's name in the policeman's voice, so crisp and official, as if it were nothing more than a label, startles Nath. It seems to startle Jack, too, There's a sharpness to his tone that wasn't there before.
We were friends. That's all.
Several people said they saw the two of you together after school in your car.
I was teaching her to drive.
Nath wishes he could see Jack's face.
Didn't they know he must be lying?
But the policeman seems to accept this.
When was the last time you saw Lydia?
The policeman asks now.
Monday afternoon, before she disappeared. What were you doing?
We were sitting in my car and smoking. Pause as the policeman makes a note of this.
And you were at the hospital, Mrs. Wolfe?
Doctor.
The policeman coughs gently.
Pardon me, Dr. Wolfe. You were at work?
I usually take the evening shift, every day except Sundays.
Did Lydia seem upset on Monday?
Another pause before Jack responds.
Lydia was always upset. Because of you,
Nath thinks. His throat is so tight the words can't squeeze through. The edges of the door waver and blur like a heat mirage. He digs his fingernail into his palm, hard, until the doorway sharpens again.
Upset about what?
Upset about everything. Jack's voice is lower now, almost a sigh.
About her grades, about her parents, about her brother leaving for college. Lots of things.
He sighs then for real. And when he speaks again, his voice is brittle, ready to snap.
How should I know?
Nath backs away from the door and creeps down the stairs. He doesn't need to hear any more. At home, not wanting to see anyone, he slips upstairs to his room to ruminate over what he's heard. There is no one for him to see, anyway. While Nath fretted under the elm tree, his family has dispersed. During the car ride, Marilyn doesn't look at James once, focusing instead on her knuckles, picking at her cuticles, fiddling with the strap of her handbag. As soon as they come inside, Marilyn says she wants to lie down, and Hannah, too, vanishes into her room without a word. For a moment, James considers joining Marilyn in their bedroom. He's filled with a deep longing to burrow against her, to feel her weight and warmth surrounding him, shielding him from everything else, to cling to her and feel her cling to him and let their bodies comfort each other. But something scratches and scratches at the edge of James's mind, and at last he lifts his keys from the table again. There is something he must do at the office. Urgently. It cannot wait another minute. When the police had asked if he wanted a copy of the autopsy, he had given them his office address. Then, yesterday, a thick manila envelope appeared in his mail cubby, and he decided he'd made a mistake. He didn't want to see it, ever. At the same time, he could not bring himself to throw it away. Instead, he slipped it into the bottom drawer of his desk and locked it. It would be there, he thought, if he ever changed his mind. He had never expected to. It is lunchtime and the office is almost empty. Only Myrna, the department secretary, still sits at her desk, changing the ribbon of her typewriter. All the other office doors are shut, their frosted glass windows dim. Now James unlocks the drawer, takes a deep breath, and slits the envelope open with his finger. He has never seen an autopsy report before, and expects charts and diagrams. But it opens like a teacher's progress report. The subject is a well-developed, well-nourished Oriental female. It tells him things he already knows. That she was 16 years old. 65 inches tall, that her hair was black that her eyes were blue.